the accent. An invitation from the Queen? Let's go! Never in a million years had Mia imagined being as excited to see Ollie's face as she was right now. Chapter 16. The briefing room on board the USS Grapple was about as sparse and unattractive as Jack had assumed it would be. The walls were coated in a layer of lime-green paint, while the floors were a darker shade, something closer to pond scum. Four rows of chairs lined the space. Up ahead was a podium, and next to that, a display screen. Above them was a mix of neon lighting fixtures and exposed air ducts. After Jack and the Rear Admiral's little chat, Stark had called in the Grapple, a salvage ship at the time conducting an operation off Galveston, Texas. She was used for a variety of tasks and particularly well-suited to deep-sea missions. Following their conversation, two things had become clear to Jack. The first was that his gumption had somehow impressed Stark. The second was that the Navy was now in charge of the operation. Stark addressed them from the front of the briefing room. Grant, Dag, Gabby, Rajesh, and Anna were seated in rapt attention. At the back were Commander Hart and Lieutenant Olson. Not surprisingly, selling Gabby on this next phase of their research expedition had not been an easy task. Although stated in a dozen different ways, the gist of her argument against pushing any further was a good old-fashioned fear of the unknown. The same reasoning that might have kept us away from the depths of the ocean or the surface of the moon. After Jack proceeded to knock down each one of her arguments, she had shifted tack and suggested they were no longer able to complete the research as outlined in their grant agreement. Jack countered by telling her the original mission hadn't changed. They had come to drill what was left of the meteorite suspected of killing the dinosaurs. Instead, they'd found what, to Jack's mind, was looking more and more like a spaceship. Of course, for all he knew, it might have landed in the crater afterward. But what if this had been what killed the dinosaurs? Any way you sliced it, finding answers required further investigation. After nearly an hour of a conversation that had ebbed and flowed from congenial to downright hostile, Gabby had finally thrown up her hands and surrendered. It was nothing new for Jack and Gabby to butt heads. Hell, it was one of the reasons he loved working with her. Jack had a point-and-shoot style. She, on the other hand, had a keen ability to spot where he'd become myopic in his thinking. Put another way, Gabby was the aiming reticule, precise, efficient, normally cool-headed, while he was the rifle. Now, they'd swapped roles, and Jack was still trying to understand why. After Gabby had thrown up the white flag, Jack's next mission was to speak with Rajesh, who had some serious reservations about dealing with the military. During his time as an MIT grad student, men from DARPA had apparently showed up on campus asking for a meeting. He had agreed and quickly discovered the focus of their questions revolved around Anna version 1.0. In her, they saw a tremendous potential to save lives on the battlefield. As Rajesh explained, their pitch had been to use her revolutionary self-learning neuron network and algorithm in order to create a whole new generation of battlefield medics. It all sounded so wonderful until Rajesh asked them about the other military applications they had in mind, the kind that involved machines designed to kill. In spite of their assurances that would never happen, Rajesh wasn't an idiot. He knew the temptation would be too great, and by then there would be no stopping them. If the military wanted to build an army of soulless killing machines, let them do it with their own code. Jack fully understood Rajesh's objections. He promised that not only would Anna be safe, but if Rajesh or even Anna had a change of heart, they could leave the expedition at any time. For her part, Anna said she was eager to fill in humanity's knowledge gap in this area. It sounded nice, but Jack wasn't convinced she had any concept of the historical magnitude of what they were about to embark on. And maybe that wasn't such a big surprise. Homo sapiens had a long tradition of peering into the black recesses of space and wondering whether we were alone. Whatever Anna and her burgeoning intelligence represented, one could argue she was the first of her kind, a new species whose time spent on Earth could be counted in months rather than millennia. Anyone born into a world with flying cars and interstellar travel couldn't help but see them as terribly normal, even banal.
Dr. Greer, Rear Admiral Stark said coolly, I asked you a question.
Jack snapped back into reality.
Sorry, I was somewhere else.
Stark motioned toward the paused image on the monitor, which showed what looked like a spacesuit.
Have you ever used an exosuit on one of your geology expeditions?
Jack leaned forward for a closer look and shook his head. He was familiar with atmospheric diving suits. The shell was made from a hard aluminum alloy and featured rotating appendages outfitted with pincers for manipulating underwater objects. Stepping into one of these 530-pound beasts essentially transformed the wearer into a massive crab. Although expensive, the suits held several advantages over traditional scuba diving gear. The most striking was the pressurized interior. Much like a one-man submarine, the wearer could essentially bring Earth's surface atmosphere with him several hundred meters under the sea. A scuba diver, on the other hand, was forced to breathe a dangerous cocktail of gases and spend hours in decompression chambers or risk the bends. Stark pressed a button on a remote, switching the image to a live feed 500 meters beneath them. On the screen were a number of Navy divers in exosuits, securing a large circular habitat to the porthole of the USO, unidentified submerged object.
Once in place, Stark explained, the orb will be your home for the next 96 hours.
96?
Jack said, shocked they weren't being given more time.
It might very well be less, Stark told them. Once agents from the ONI arrive, I got a feeling they're going to want you and your people gone. So my advice is get in there and do as much as you can in the time you have.
The ONI stood for the Office of Naval Intelligence. Jack bit his lip. Things might have been a lot worse. The Navy could very well have called his bluff and thrown them off the rig back to the U.S. Stark zoomed out with the underwater camera, revealing just how the tiny orb looked next to the alien structure.
Let me bring in Captain Manuel Sanchez, commander of the USS Grapple, to explain a little more about your new home.
Sanchez strode to the front of the briefing room. A short Mexican-American in navy khakis, Sanchez was clean-cut with a slight deformity on his upper lip. He spoke slowly, struggling, it seemed, to keep his speech as clear as possible.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and,
Captain Sanchez's gaze dropped to Anna, seated in the front row.
Anna,
Jack offered, knowing Rajesh would have looked on with delight as the captain struggled. Sanchez's face became strained. Clearly Stark hadn't informed him that a robot was on board. Recovering quickly, he carried on with his presentation.
The orb is a deep-sea research habitat capable of supporting a crew of 10 members on 5 separate levels, he told them.
He pulled up an image on screen.
It will also be your home for the next few days. As you can see, a narrow staircase provides access to each deck. Decks 1 and 2 are berthing quarters. Each of you will be assigned a bunk and a locker where you can store your personal items. The middle deck features a small mess with tables and chairs. 2 microwaves will allow you to heat up the pre-prepared meals we will provide you with. The lower 2 decks will house a comms room and science lab. The orb has 2 airlocks. The first is where the submersible will dock. The second leads to the structure. As we speak, Navy divers are beginning the process of pumping water from the porthole. A series of micro ROVs sent into the structure have revealed a chamber no more than 10 square feet. Within the hour, the last of the water should be pumped out and the orb secured in place.
Jack spoke up.
What if we run into a problem and need to evacuate?
In the case of emergency, Sanchez informed them, the orb can be manually released from the airlock connecting it to the USO. Compressed air will then fill a series of ballast tanks and bring you to the surface.
The captain then flicked to an image of a man in a baggy suit.
While on board, you may wear your regular clothing. However, specially designed biosuits must be worn within the target structure at all times. Failure to comply may result in cross-contamination or death.
Dag, his brain filled with endless knowledge on dinosaur bones, looked worried.
Cross-contamination?
Grant, the biologist, jumped in.
It'll prevent us from leaving our microbes behind and mucking up any data we collect. The real question is, after millions of years on the bottom of the ocean, have any alien bacteria even survived? Gabby crossed her arms and held her elbows. I'm starting to think this was what Stephen Hawking meant when he said we might not survive first contact. Didn't the Europeans wipe out millions of the native population with pathogen-carrying blankets?
What about the air? Dag asked. Once we're on board, will we be able to breathe?
Rear Admiral Stark popped back up.
We're not sure yet, but your suits will be able to monitor air levels. Regardless, you're advised to keep your helmets on at all times.
A cough from the back of the briefing room drew Stark's attention.
Oh, yes. There's one more member of the team I should introduce you to.
Stark raised a hand and waved someone forward from the back of the room. All present shifted in their seats to see who it was. From out of the shadows, a thin man in his 40s emerged, wearing a dark suit that was last in style sometime in the mid-90s. His thinning hair was parted in the middle and combed flat on either side of his skull.
"This is Dr. Eugene Jarecki," Stark said, a note of reluctance in his voice. "A theoretical physicist sent to us compliments of Uncle Sam."
Uncle Sam was code for the government, which in turn was code for bureaucracy and red tape and meddling. At least that was Jack's reading of the pained expression on the Rear Admiral's face.
"Greetings," Eugene said, drawing his hand in an arc before him. "You can call me Gene or Dr. Gene, whatever you prefer."
He was a soprano with blocked sinuses.
"I'm here from the Office of Outer Space Affairs."
An air of bewilderment filled the room.
"That sounds made up,"
Dag blurted with typical Swedish bluntness. Eugene's eyebrows flickered with resentment.
"I can assure you, the office is very real. We are located on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C.
"Well, it certainly doesn't get any more governmental than that, does it?"
Grant said. Scanning the room, Jack registered the mood before speaking.
"I think we were all expecting the men in black. At the very least, a couple of guys in dark suits with threats that if we spoke a word of what we saw, we'd be made to disappear."
Before Eugene could respond, Gabby piped in.
"Exactly how many people are in the OOSA?" she asked, saying the letter slowly to make sure she got the acronym right.
Only me," he said. "But you see, after Project Blue Book wrapped up in 69, our government was pretty much done with the subject of aliens."
Jack shook his head in disbelief. He knew that Blue Book had been convened as a public relations gig designed to dampen the UFO hysteria rampant at the time. The major concern back then was that the lines of communication were being clogged with wild claims of UFO sightings and encounters, the same lines that needed to remain clear in case of impending Soviet attack. Could it really be that the U.S. government thought so little about our chances of encountering an alien civilization that they had an office staffed by one person? Could the stories of secret cover-ups and captured spacecraft have been little more than an urban myth? Jack had never pretended to be particularly well-versed on the subject, although, by the same token, he never considered everyone in the UFO community a complete nutjob. Many were, no doubt about it, but more than a few had seemed reputable. Jack had to admit he was rather disappointed. If nothing else, the sad state of the OOSA only reinforced the idea that, in more ways than one, they truly were entering uncharted territory.
"All right, folks," Stark cut in. "Hate to break up the party, but the submersible dives in an hour, with or without you."
Chapter 17. As ordered, Jack and the others returned to the rig to assemble any gear and scientific instruments they would need for their time on the orb. He had no sooner stepped off the helipad than a deckhand approached him.
"Doc, a call came in over the sat phone from a Gordon LeMay. Said it was urgent."
Jack sighed, feeling a cold dread settle over him. Something was wrong. In the 5 years they'd been working together, Gordon had never once called him in the field. Had there been an accident at the farm? Had the property been foreclosed on? Moving quickly, Jack made his way down the walkway and into the superstructure. 3 stories up was his cabin. When he arrived, he dug in his pocket for the key, only to find the door unlocked and slightly ajar. That was strange. He never left his cabin open. Right away, he dialed the general frequency on the rig to ask if anyone had been in his cabin. A few voices came back, informing him they weren't aware of anyone doing so. With growing concern, Jack pushed his way inside. There, he found what looked like the aftermath of a Category 5 hurricane.
picture frames and possessions had been thrown from every surface and sent crashing to the floor. His dresser drawers had been removed, the clothes dumped into small peaks and valleys at his feet. Even his mattress had been upended. Jack kicked at a pile of t-shirts by his feet and swore. The toe of his boot struck something hard mixed in with his clothing. He reached down and scooped up his smartphone, the one he turned off whenever he was on an expedition. A moment later, he found his wallet, $80 in crisp $20 bills, still tucked inside, along with bank and credit cards. Whoever did this hadn't been after money or electronics. Their motivation seemed clear enough. They wanted info on the alien object. But who? Admiral Stark was the first name that came to mind. Could this have been his Navy goons, the VBSS, Visit Board Search and Seizure Team, that had stormed aboard earlier? A not-so-subtle attempt to get their hands on the digital packet Jack had said he'd sent off for safekeeping? Jack hadn't been in his cabin since the morning, which gave whoever had carried this out plenty of opportunity to rifle through his belongings. The veins in his neck bulged with anger as he set the mattress back on his bed and dialed Gord on the sat phone. The vet and caretaker answered on the first ring.
"I'm guessing you have more bad news for me?" Jack asked, removing his ball cap and rubbing his temples with his left hand.
"I thought you should know. There's a problem with the pigs," Gord said, cutting right to the chase.
Normally, slicing off the fat was just the way Jack liked it, but given the situation, he could have used a gentler lead-in.
"What do you mean? What's wrong with them?"
Gord grunted, his deep voice reverberating clearly over a bad line.
"Not sure. I've quarantined Harold and a handful of others, just in case it's some sort of virus. Problem is, their symptoms are all over the place."
Jack set his cap back on snugly.
"I don't understand." "Frankly, Jack, neither do I. See, I found Harold lying on the ground squealing like mad. Turns out he had fractures in both of his front trotters and three of his ribs. Figured that last bit must have happened when he fell over. But I can't make sense of what caused it. The flesh on two of the others, Betsy and Tommy, is all red and swollen. Looks to me like a nasty sunburn. Then, this morning, I found Jezebel walking straight into the fence post, over and over, like she intended to walk right through it."
Jezebel was a bright sow, maybe the smartest on the farm. She could understand about 100 commands.
"What about the horses and the llamas?" "The other animals seem fine so far," Gord replied. "I've been feeding and taking good care of them, like always. I'm sorry, Jack. I wish there was more I could tell you."
"I understand. Listen, I'd tell you to call a vet, but you were one of the best in the county.
Keep an eye on him. I may be out of touch for a few days."
"Oh, did you find the money in the safe?"
"I did," Gord said, "and used it to fend off the bank and pay the farmhands. But we were still short. I just hope those two boys don't run off on me now, not when I need them most."
Jack felt the walls closing in on him. On the one hand, he was about to literally go where no man had gone before. On the other, he could only watch helplessly as his home and everything that gave his life meaning melted away.
"You still there, Jack?"
"I am, Gord.
Believe me, I hate to burden you with all this bad news."
"It's not your fault," Jack assured him. "As soon as I get a chance, I'll send more money."
"You folks found that meteorite you were looking for?"
Jack smiled.
"You could say that. That's no small feat. I'm sure your father, wherever he is, would be proud."
Looking down, Jack saw that he was rubbing his fingers again. The pads were growing red and tender. This was no time to relive the past, and so Jack simply agreed with Gord and told his friend to take care. Jack tossed a few things into a bag and then piled everything else onto his bunk. 96 hours from now, as Stark had made clear, he would return and sort everything out. Jack returned to the helipad to find Billy Brenner, along with a handful of scientists and deckhands, loading up the Navy chopper. Much of the scientific instrumentation had been packed inside boxes labeled Delicate and This Side Up, but they'd be spending the next few days in the cramped confines of a tiny habitat 500 meters beneath the sea. Fancy as it was, a thermal cycler didn't keep your breath fresh or your armpits from stinking up the joint. When you were living in tight quarters, personal hygiene was vitally important. Ask any astronaut who spent time aboard the ISS, International Space Station. As the resident astrophysicist, Gabby couldn't agree more. She saw the shaving kit under Jack's arm and motioned to her own. The two of them climbed on board.
Both helicopter doors were open, and when Jack glanced to his right, he could see their next destination, bobbing less than 100 yards away, the USS Grapple. Dag, Grant, Rajesh, and Anna boarded next, settling into the seats that remained.
"I forgot how much you hate flying," Gabby professed. "You look like a schoolboy waiting at the principal's office."
Jack tried to grin, but the muscles in his face weren't cooperating. He clenched his fists and let go, watching the blood pooling back into his arms.
"Is something else the matter?"
she asked, worried. In the cockpit, the pilots were running through a final round of checks. Jack shook his head. He had no intention of talking about the break-in. That was squarely between him and Rear Admiral Stark. And as for the problems on the farm, discussing subjects for which there was no clear solution would only leave him feeling worse about the whole damn thing. Instead, he decided to redirect the conversation.
"How's your mom?"
Gabby's mother was nearly 80 and recently diagnosed with lung cancer. To the doctors, it hardly mattered that the woman had never smoked a day in her life. The light in Gabby's eyes faded a little. "She's as strong as ever. With a lot of arm twisting and a touch of luck, we got her into a promising clinical trial over at Mount Sinai. We're hoping it'll buy her a few more years." Gabby's mother was not only her parent, she was Gabby's whole life. After her father's death in a car accident 30 years earlier, Gabby had forfeited anything resembling a personal life in order to keep her mother company. They were more than mother and daughter. They were best friends, something Jack's own fractured past had never enabled him to fully understand.
"And what about you, Gabby? Maybe it's time you had a life of your own."
"I do have a life," she countered quickly, "through my work and my hiking."
"I'm talking about a husband," Jack pushed.
Gabby scoffed. "I'm in my mid-50s. You know what the dating scene is like for a woman my age? We're looking for someone to spend time with while most men are hunting for a supermodel."
"You're not sad you never had kids?" he asked.
It was a touchy personal question, but Jack was asking himself just as much as he was asking her. She regarded him and then looked away.
"It's funny how you can know someone for only 10 years only to realize you know so little about them."
She was talking about their decade-long friendship, but she might as well have been talking about Jack and the secrets he kept, even from those he considered close friends.
"I grew up in a small town in Nebraska," Gabby said, apparently willing to share, "where you obeyed your parents and, above all, your God. The rules were quite simple, but for some reason, I had a real hard time following them. Met a boy my senior year of high school and did something we had no business doing. There was no such thing as sex ed back then." She clasped her hands together. "Anyway, a few months later, I realized I was pregnant and all hell broke loose. Imagine me at 16 taking care of a little baby. Even back then I had dreams of becoming a scientist. Suddenly, all that was gone."
"I never knew," Jack said, placing his hand over hers.
"How could you? I was sent away to Smith Falls for 8 months. The plan was for me to have the kid and then give it up for adoption. There were other, more practical reasons for my disappearance, though.
My father didn't want the neighbors talking. My mother reluctantly went along. As much as I hated my father's reasoning, I knew there was really no other choice. So away I went, and 7 months later, I gave birth to a baby girl. Only got a brief glimpse before she was taken away. The weeks leading up to the birth, I wanted nothing more than for the baby to be out of me. But, you see, all that changed when I saw her beautiful little face. Suddenly, all those bad feelings disappeared, just as the cramps and the pain had faded away."
"Did you ever try to find her?" Jack asked. "Reach out?"
The whine of the motor began, the rotors turning in a slow circle.
"Last year I started the process. It took months of research and mounds of red tape before I found out she lived somewhere on the West Coast and had a family of her own, but she declined to meet."
Gabby's eyes glazed over.
"Can't say I blame her. The choices we make."
She was lying to herself, but Jack let it go.
"Life is a series of choices," she said reflectively. "An endless array of yeses or noes. If I'd said yes to the baby, I probably wouldn't be here now, about to dive into something no human has ever seen before."
The rotors kicked up a mighty racket as the individual blades disappeared from view. Gabby put her headset on and said one last thing.
"What would you have done?" she asked him.
Jack lowered the mic to his lips.
"Only someone who lived through it had the right to make that call."
The chopper pushed off the landing pad and began the short hop to the grapple.
Slowly, Jack's mind began to move away from the secret life Gabby had kept from him all these years, and further still from his own personal problems. His thoughts settled squarely on the metallic structure sitting in a pocket on the seafloor, an object which was sure to hold secrets of its own.
Chapter 18. The parking complex Mia and Ollie were hiding in was three stories high and in desperate need of repair. Sections of exposed rebar poked out from the crumbling concrete pillar he had pulled up next to in his Toyota 4x4. He had brought her to the business district, a safe and more upscale part of Santa Rem, although safe was something of a misnomer. Slightly less dangerous was probably a more accurate way of putting it. Mia glanced down at her phone. The ringer was off, but the number showing on the screen was the same one that had already called a million times since last night. "Don't answer it," Ollie warned her. "I won't. It's probably the police." He leaned over, studying the number. "It's a local number. You may be right." "Have you used your phone at all?" he asked, worried.
"A little."
"I suggest you turn it off completely, unless you want them to find you." Mia hesitated. She still hadn't spoken to Paul or Zoe to be sure they were safe. He reached over, took the device in his right hand, and held down the power button. The screen went black. "This isn't a game," he told her. "I know that, Ollie, but you're asking me to cut myself off from the most important people in my life." Mia's voice wavered. Her clothes were wrinkled and smelled of fast food.
"What if they try to call?"
"That's exactly how the authorities will find you. Most people still don't realize that this innocent-looking computer in our hands is nothing more than a tracking device." Mia grew quiet. She hadn't asked for any of this. She couldn't help wondering how things might have turned out differently had she only refused Alan's package. Her mind traced through her flight from the hotel and the group of men who had tried to assault her. At last came the question that had been on the tip of her tongue for close to an hour. "How'd you know where I was?" she asked, clutching her knapsack the way people clutched couch cushions while watching a scary movie. "Oh, I didn't," he said. He scanned behind them for signs of danger before settling back on her. "I'd been driving around for hours. Your colleague, the Brit with the tea fetish, said you'd run off like a dingo into the night." She gave him a look. "All right, I added the dingo part. But he said you took the emergency stairs, so I told police I'd help them find you and got in my truck." Mia's body tensed. "Help them?" "Oh, never mind that. I'm not paid enough to do their jobs for them. I just didn't want them thinking I was involved." "I didn't mean to kill him," Mia pleaded, feeling that old reservoir of guilt firing up again. "Just like you had no intention of shooting those idiots on the street," he chuckled, rubbing his hand along the edges of the steering wheel. "Course, I have no interest in turning you in, especially not to the buffoons in the Santa MPD. Any jerk with half a brain could see what that bloke did to your hotel room door." The soft features of her face shifted into something like hope. "You think the police will believe me?" "They might, although around here there are no guarantees," he said. "Depends on whether you're ready to pay a few bribes and then roll the dice. You'll be put on trial first, that's for sure. This isn't Texas or Florida or wherever the heck you can stand your ground and expect to be let off. First, you'll await your trial in a Brazilian jail, and then hope to hell the prosecution isn't planning to make an example of you."
"Example?"
"Sure, a beautiful and educated American woman." The fingers of both hands gripped the wheel as Ollie let out a sardonic laugh. Mia felt a smile creep over her face as her mind traced over the word beautiful before she snuffed it out. "A Sheila like you? Heck, it'll be just like that Amanda Knox, the way her sexually liberated attitude rattled those uptight Italian detectives and prosecutors. I can imagine the same thing will happen with you, but who can really say for sure?" It didn't take more than a little common sense to understand Ollie was probably right. At least with the American legal system back home, imperfect as it was, she knew what she'd be up against. Over here, she'd be putting her faith in a judiciary that might be rigged against her for no other reason than she was a woman with an offending passport. Surely the situation in the Gulf wasn't helping things either. With Cuba standing up to what it perceived as American bullying, Brazil had fallen in line to support the communist country's cause. On top of the legal risks, Mia would almost certainly become a political pawn in a proxy war between the United States and Latin America. She buried her face in her hands, overwhelmed by how badly the deck had been stacked against her. A few seconds went by before she felt Ollie's hand on her back. "Don't cry," he said, uneasy. Mia lifted her head. Her cheeks were dry. "I cried all my tears a long time ago. I just don't know what to do. Why don't you start by telling me what happened?" She studied the hard lines on his face, wondering if he could be trusted. "I'm not sure." "Listen," he said, pointing to the camera gear in the back seat. "Well, I've got a deadline of my own to meet. If I had any intention of turning you in, we'd be at police headquarters by now, not parked in this decrepit lot." Mia knew she had to start trusting someone, or else the people after her would soon finish what they had started. Centering herself, she began by recounting the attack, ending right at the moment he arrived. "You ever used a gun before?" His question surprised her. "That's all you can say, after everything I just told you?" "My friends always told me I like to get straight to the point," he said, grinning. "So you have friends?" He let out a deep burst of laughter. "Hard to believe, I know." After a moment, he settled into something more serious. "About that gun, I sure didn't mean any disrespect. The way you told the story, it sounded to me like you might have had the safety on." Her face dropped. "Oh, maybe I did." She smiled, embarrassed. "Show me your pistol." Mia raised her bruised wrist. "You knocked it out of my hand when you came charging in." He gritted his teeth and rolled his bottom lip in a silent apology. Ollie pulled out his own gun, a Beretta 9mm. "I've been meaning to ask you," she said. "Where on earth did you get that?" "When in Brazil," he said, "do as the Brazilians. If you think I'm dumb enough to drive around this country without some kind of protection, you're crazier than I thought." He removed the magazine and racked the slide, popping the round out of the chamber. Before handing it to her, he showed her the safety, flicking it off and on with his thumb. "It was the heat of the moment, Ollie," she said, her complexion still a little pale. "I hope you're not trying to rub it in." He shook his head. "Absolutely not. The heat of the moment, as you say, is the difference between life and death. You never know when you'll need to pull the trigger for real." Mia took the gun and fiddled with the safety, pointing it out in front of her. After a few more practice runs, she handed it back. "You still haven't told me what you did to the Brazilian bloke that wanted you dead. You pissing his cornflakes or something?" Ollie's shit-eating grin was back in full force. "It's complicated. You got something better to do than talk? Get back home, maybe?" He didn't seem convinced. "That'll depend on what this is about." Ollie did have a point, and she couldn't deny he had risked his neck to save her when it seemed everyone else was trying to do the opposite. Mia drew in a deep breath and went even further back this time, going over everything she knew. She was taking a chance, but at this point in the game, she had nothing else to lose. In a world filled with adversaries, she was thankful for at least one friend, even if only for a while. She told him about Alan's work and their feud, skipping over the salacious details that were frankly none of his business. She told him about Alan's discovery of Salzburg a few years back, and the disorder's emergence sometime in the 90s. She also told him about the encrypted data Alan had sent her, and his belief that he had located some sort of message in this new and mysterious human chromosome. "But why you?" Ollie asked. "I don't mean any disrespect, but if I understood your story, the guy hated your guts." She found herself about to relitigate her entire disagreement with Alan and bit her tongue. "It's complicated, but I do know that when I left, he considered me his protege. Waiting for a bloke who's gone underground to contact you is liable to take months." "He has gone underground," she corrected him, "but not in the way you're suggesting." Understanding broke on Ollie's face. "He's dead?" She nodded. "Maybe I'm better off throwing this stuff in the trash." He considered this. "And if there's something in what that Alan fella discovered that could help those sick people, what then? I mean, didn't you say the emergency room at Santarém Municipal was suddenly filled with folks who had Salzburg?" "Salzburg," she corrected him, considering his point. "If someone is after you, do you really think they'll stop just because you threw the stuff away? It sounds to me like this Alan handed you a death sentence, and the only way out is to figure out what he found and get it in the right hands." "So what do you suggest?" she asked. The grip on her bag had slackened a little.
Ollie balled one hand into a fist and drummed his fingers against the space between his knuckles. He remained like this for several minutes, deep in thought. Then,
I got it. You mentioned something about an encrypted flash drive.
Yeah, but I don't have the username or password.
We might not need it. I did a story a couple years ago on computer hackers. I interviewed white hats, black hats, and even a few blokes claiming to work for the Chinese and Russian governments. One of those white hat gents was a computer genius living in Argentina. Goes by the name Armoni. I can send him an email, see if he'd be willing to meet you.
She hesitated. Ollie pulled out his phone.
What's wrong?
I just thought maybe you could... He glanced over at her, his chin sunken into his chest.
What? Go with you? Sorry, no can do. I got a deadline to meet.
All right, fine, Mia said, biting her lip. It was just a thought. I'm a grown woman. I can take care of myself.
I have no doubt you can. Besides, I don't know a thing about genetics.
Maybe not, but you know how to stay alive. I make one mistake and I'm done.
Ollie held her gaze before he returned to his phone, his fingers dancing over the tiny digital keys. 30 seconds later, he looked proud of himself and pushed his back against the seat.
That's done. First, we wait for a response, and then get you on a plane.
But won't the cops be watching outgoing commercial flights?
He winked at her. Those aren't the ones I'm thinking of.
Chapter 19. Commander Hart met the scientists on the Grapple's helipad. Toward the stern, a boom arm maneuvered in place over a large white submersible, the name Trident stenciled on the side in bold black letters. Hart glanced back as Jack watched the sailors attach the load hook to the sub.
That's our ride, Hart told him. A real beauty, isn't she?
The SEAL smiled in a rare display of lightheartedness, the edges of his dense beard rising to meet his eyes narrowed into half-slits.
So long as she gets us there in one piece, Jack said, not ashamed of the uncertainty creeping into his bones.
He wondered if his hatred for flying would be matched by the underwater equivalent.
Leave your things on the chopper, Hart instructed them, brushing aside Jack's concerns in the process. The sailors will load them on board after we're settled.
Hart led them down the walkway and toward the stern.
Aren't we going inside for a final briefing? Gabby asked, a note of desperation in her voice.
No, ma'am. This bus is leaving.
Jack followed, noticing for the first time Commander Hart wasn't weighed down by body armor, ammo magazines, or any visible weapons.
No guns? He asked.
Doc, this is a scientific expedition. What would we need guns for?
Jack glanced back, exchanging bewildered looks with the scientists. Ahead of them, the sailors were rolling the metal staircase in place. Getting in and out of the Trident was accomplished through a sail hatch at the top of the submersible.
I was hoping to have a final word with Rear Admiral Stark, Jack protested.
Commander Hart stopped, a look of annoyance spreading over his features.
What for? The USO is a mile across and half a mile high. 96 hours won't be nearly enough time to get what we need.
The Rear Admiral was very clear about that in the briefing. You're here to find out what this thing is and why it's here with the time you have. Anything else you find is icing on the cake.
And what's your role in all of this? Jack asked, sweating now and not just from the stifling heat.
Our mission is to keep the lot of you out of trouble. Our second mission is to determine whether the beings who left this here intend to do us harm.
10 minutes later, the passengers and most of their gear were stored away. A seaman checked that all were accounted for before sealing the hatch. With a sudden jolt, the massive boom arm went to work, lifting the sub off the tarmac and slowly swinging it out over the water. Jack found it hard to breathe. Inside, the craft was sweltering. A small mezzanine hung above them toward the bow, where the cockpit was located. Below that was the forward airlock. In the center of that, a tiny porthole window. Rajesh sat clutching Anna in his lap. He had opted to forego bringing a suitcase in order to free up enough space for a few more of her processors.
"Ladies and gentlemen, travel time to the orb will be 30 minutes, Hart announced over the loudspeaker. "The weather at our destination is a chilly 23 degrees. As we start our descent, please make sure your seat backs and tray tables are in their full upright position and make sure your seat belt is securely fastened at all times. Thank you."
Dr. Eugene Jarecki glanced down, digging into the seat for a safety belt.
By the looks of it, his growing panic at not finding one was the highlight of Lieutenant Olson's day. If the SEALs could have gotten away with hanging the poor doctor on a locker by his underpants, surely they would have. But who knew? The day was still young. The tiny portholes along the sides of the sub revealed a strange world bathed in shifting blues and emerald greens. Soon, those colors began to darken before the sea became altogether black. Grant's face was pressed against the porthole nearest him. "Hardly any light filters down further than 200 meters." The bizarre and rather frightening sensation of floating in space was now even more acute. Any concept of up, down, left, or right was completely meaningless. As if in response, the outside lights switched on, providing those inside a semblance of orientation. Jack became aware that he was calm and clear-headed. Flying under the waves didn't send him into a panic the way it did in the air. The dangers were no less real, but his mind somehow drew a distinction he did not understand, but one he was thankful for nevertheless. Before long, they entered the fissure, the gaping wound created by the blast wave. This was something Stark had asked him about privately on several occasions. More than intrigued, the Admiral seemed positively obsessed with it. Was he evaluating how such an event might be weaponized? Surely not, since the power required to create the kind of gamma-ray dispersion they had experienced was likely far beyond the means of modern science. Stark also wanted to know if it would happen again, as to which Jack was equally ignorant. Despite their concerns, the Navy had gone ahead and secured the orb to the USO's opening anyway. But given the limited amount of information he had, the only conclusion Jack had been able to draw was that when the drill bit had struck the outer hull, it had set off some sort of defensive countermeasure, a theory which had led to the formation of an even more troubling thought. What else might it do if it felt attacked? Chapter 20. A shimmering mirage soon began to materialize from out of the gloom. Gradually it grew, until finally it took on a distinctly rounded shape. They were seeing the orb. Minutes later, both the bow and stern airlocks became visible, along with clustered rows of tiny portholes, a handful on each of the habitat's 5 levels. On land, it might have been an impressive sight. They were told the habitat was the approximate height of a T-Rex, which was to say 40 feet. But down here, next to the alien object, it looked far more like a pimple. 10 meters, the submersible pilot called out as they drew even with the rear airlock. This was by far the most dangerous part of the operation. Here, the slightest miscalculation, a nervous twitch, could send them thudding into the habitat and rupturing both hulls. At over 500 meters down, their chances for survival were zilch. 5 meters, 4, 3, 2, 1, contact. The sub lurched forward, nearly pushing Gabby out of her seat. Jack swung an arm out to keep her in place. Then came a loud clang as the locking mechanism was engaged. "Welcome to the orb, folks," Hart said, hanging the mic on the nearest bulkhead. One of the pilots climbed down from the cockpit and spun the airlock door. Air hissed out as the pressure equalized. Jack stepped onto the orb. He turned to Grant, who was right behind him. "It's got that new car smell." It took close to an hour to unload all of their gear and equipment. Tight quarters didn't begin to describe what they encountered on the orb. Jack's grandfather, step-grandfather to be precise, had served aboard a sub during World War II. His grandfather had only spoken about it once, and when he did, he'd said the overall sensation was like riding inside a clown car with 30 other men. Sure, the submersible was a confined space, but they weren't expected to live there. Spiral metal staircases led from floor to floor. The top 2 levels held a series of bunks, 2 high and shoulder-width apart. A 6-foot length of foam wrapped in plastic served as a mattress. For a pillow, they were given a chunk of foam covered in cotton fabric. No one complained, nor should they have. With any luck, they would be so exhausted from studying whatever was inside the structure, they'd be able to fall asleep on a slab of concrete. The middle deck was where the galley and mess were located. A small fridge and microwave stood at one end. A handful of tables and chairs were scattered about the rest of the space. Over by the fridge was the inner airlock, which led to the USO. Jack crossed the room and peered through the porthole. Recessed neon lighting gave the chamber a sterile, forbidding feel. Red hazmat suits lined both walls. Beyond this airlock was one more, and beyond that, a world no human had seen with their own eyes. Below the mess was where the comms equipment would be located. This was Olson's world, and he was busy checking that the fiber optic link was working. It was from here that the orb would keep in contact with Rear Admiral Stark, who had decided to remain on board the USS Grapple. On the bottom deck was where most of the science would take place. Already, the bulk of the instruments had been set up. The crew, as they were now known, was scattered about the orb, performing a variety of final sorting tasks as they hurried to put the place in order. Jack found Rajesh and Anna on the comms level. Rajesh was busy setting up the powerful computers used to maintain and expand Anna's impressive intellect. The fiber optic cable would also allow her to access the servers on the rig. "Hello, Dr. Greer," Anna said, turning her digital face to watch him descend the spiral staircase. Jack spread out his hands, motioning to their surroundings. "So, what do you think?" It was a question more designed to fill an awkward silence than a legitimate inquiry. As impressive as she was, he couldn't help feeling a little irked by the way her deep brown eyes were regarding him. She blinked twice before answering. The facial tics were a nice touch, Jack thought. "The average human takes up to 3 square feet when standing," Anna told him, her expression calm and jovial. 4.5 square feet while seated. I've calculated each level of the habitat to be 500 square feet for a total of 2,500 square feet. I then subtracted 1/5 of that for furniture, scientific instrumentation, and computer hardware. That leaves 2,000 square feet to be shared among 9 individuals. Given the circumstances, I think it's more than adequate. Jack rolled his eyes. She still didn't quite get context, but there was something else she did get that Jack found interesting. When dividing up the orb's square footage among its inhabitants, she'd included herself among those counted. On some level, she seemed to understand the concept of inclusion, or at least felt, or maybe believed, that she was one of them. Jack's mother had always hated when people fed the family dog at the table, said it confused the animal into thinking it was human. Maybe the same thing was happening with her? Her head tilted slightly. "Penny for your thoughts, Dr. Greer?" Rajesh was still fishing for a plug behind the table when Jack bent down and grabbed it for him.
"Her spatial awareness and facial recognition are truly impressive."
He didn't know fancy computer talk, but he was confident Rajesh understood what he was getting at. "Dr. Greer," Anna said, trying to get his attention. Rajesh sat straight up, his face slightly distorted from the pooling blood.
"Much of that has come from improving her optics."
"Dr. Greer," Anna droned on again in a polite, monotone voice. When she called Jack's name a third time, Rajesh got firm with her, pointing at Jack so Anna could see.
"Do not be a nuisance. Dr. Greer and I are speaking."
He leaned in closer to Jack. "When I told you she was like a 10-year-old child, I was not exaggerating." Her expression became saddened. "My apologies. I was waiting for Dr. Greer to respond to my question."
"If someone does not respond to your inquiry," Rajesh informed her, "it either means they are busy or do not feel like answering."
"Or they did not hear the question." Anna looked at Jack and smiled.
"How long did it take your team to program her facial expressions?" Jack asked, feeling Anna watching him.
Rajesh stood and clapped the dust off his hands.
"Program? No, sir. We did no such thing."
"Beg your pardon?"
"Anna developed those on her own, from observing and interacting with humans. The rest she got from watching television."
Jack blinked. "TV?"
"Oh, yes."
Rajesh turned to her, intent on illustrating his point.
"What's your favorite program, Anna?"
"Sesame Street," she began. Rajesh beamed like a proud father and wiggled his head from side to side.
"And Jersey Shore," she continued. The answer caught Jack off guard, and he burst out laughing.
Rolling his eyes, Rajesh fell into a nearby chair.
"Sometimes, when we aren't paying her enough attention, she sneaks onto the web and watches videos on YouTube."
Jack shook his head in disbelief, a mind filled with Sesame Street and Jersey Shore. Now there was a scary thought. After that, he left Rajesh to finish his work and headed up 2 levels to his bunk. There he found Grant lying down. The nearly 60-year-old biologist had the berth beneath Jack's. As Jack came within a few feet, he noticed Grant's cheeks and forehead were bright red. In several places, the scientist's skin appeared to be blistering, "You feeling all right?" he asked.
Grant glanced over without getting up.
"Tip-top. Just a little hot under the collar is all. Perhaps I caught a touch of sun when I wasn't paying attention."
They were off the coast of Mexico, so that wasn't out of the question. In fact, on the rig, sunscreen was considered as mandatory as hard hats and life jackets.
"I just want to make sure you aren't sick," Jack said. "I'm going to get a thermometer."
"Oh, for heaven's sake," Grant shot back, gearing up for a fight before quickly realizing it wasn't a battle he had any hope of winning. As promised, Jack returned a moment later and inserted one of those newfangled thermometers into Grant's ear. When Jack checked the readings, he saw the biologist was telling the truth. His temperature was normal. But something about Grant's skin reminded Jack of the conversation he'd had with Gord. The caretaker had described burn marks on Betsy and Tommy, two piglets on his rescue farm. Of course, it was silly to believe there was any kind of connection, but that was how Jack's mind worked. The world was like a giant puzzle upended onto the floor, much like the clothes in his ransacked cabin, and he couldn't help but hold pieces out two or three at a time, looking for any that might fit together. A voice over a PA system brought everyone to attention. It was Commander Hart.
"Time to suit up, folks. We're going in."
Chapter 21. It was an hour later that Ollie heard back from his hacker contact, Armoni.
"He's willing to meet, but he wants $10,000 up front."
"$10,000?" Mia exclaimed, feeling the wind from yet another door slamming in her face.
"Armoni may be a white hat, but that doesn't mean he works for free."
"Perhaps, but I can't get anywhere near that much."
"Let me see what I can do," Ollie said, and spent the next several minutes emailing back and forth. "I got him down to 2,000, but he wants it wired first."
Mia crossed her arms tightly over her knapsack again.
"What guarantee do I have he won't just take the money and blow me off? Tell him 1,500, and only when we meet."
Ollie grinned.
"You're one tough biscuit," he said,
returning to his phone to relay the message. Mia giggled.
"You mean cookie?"
He glanced up.
"Huh?"
"In America, we say tough cookie."
Ollie pulled out his best Bogart impression.
"You're not in America anymore, sweetheart."
A moment later, his face lit up.
"He agreed."
A sense of relief washed over her. Ollie then showed her the email where Armoni included his address. He instructed her not to put it in her phone, but to memorize it. She stared intently at the email, committing the address to memory. She repeated it over and over. They pulled out of the parking structure and headed for the airfield on the outskirts of Santarem. By the side of the road, a group of older men sat outside drinking beer and playing dominoes. A scooter zipped by at high speeds, a family of five piled precariously on every available surface.
"Oh, I sent a text to someone else I know," Ollie said, weaving through traffic. "Bloke I met at a local watering hole. He's a bush pilot named Gustavo who said he'd bring you to Manaus. From there, you can buy yourself a ticket to Argentina. Cash only."
That last part he said extra slow, his Australian drawl on full display, as if to emphasize the importance of staying off the grid. He swung into a bank parking lot moments later, instructing Mia to head alone to the ATM. It was better he not be caught on camera anywhere near her, or the police might arrest him, too. Mia soon returned with a stack of bills. She had removed the maximum she could from her checking account, and then borrowed against her credit cards. She leafed through the money, her lips moving in unison.
$3,000.
He laid a hand on it.
"Good. Now put that away, would you, before someone carjacks us? And not all in the same pocket. Put some of it in your socks as insurance."
She did as he suggested, thankful for all of his helpful tips. As Ollie pulled out, he saw that she was looking at him.
"Look, I didn't exactly grow up in a picturesque part of Brisbane," he told her. "My father was unemployed and drank to numb the sting of a life he felt he didn't deserve. There was often little food and plenty of discipline. For breakfast, we were given a slice of plain white bread. For dinner, we got a beating. Sometimes, when I was lucky, I got a beating and a bowl of cold soup. Trust me, you spend your childhood living with an old man who hates you for no good reason, and then your adolescence running with the wrong crowd to escape your crappy home life, you tend to pick up a few survival secrets the average bloke doesn't need to worry about."
Mia's eyes traced down to his hands as they worked the steering wheel, taking note of the nicks and scars. These were clearly places where a difficult life had left its mark.
and those were only the scars she could see. 10 minutes later, they were at the airfield. Ollie's friend flew a green-striped four-seat Cessna he kept at the far end of a grassy field. To their left was a long line of small aircraft parked on the apron, most of them two- and four-seaters. To their right was a row of hangars with open doors where mechanics were busy performing maintenance.
"There he is," Ollie said, motioning ahead. "If there's one thing I can say about Gustavo, he seems very dependable."
"Seems?" Mia repeated with alarm. "I thought you knew this guy."
"We've shared a few cocktails here and there."
Ollie sounded defensive.
"Don't forget, lass, I've only been in this godforsaken country a few weeks. The accent may be deceiving, but I'm not exactly a native."
They pulled up to the plane and jumped out. Everything Mia owned at the moment was contained within the little red knapsack now slung over both of her shoulders. Gustavo was wiping down the ivory-colored wing of his plane with a rag.
"Thank you for doing this, mate," Ollie said, gripping Gustavo's hand in a long shake. "I know it was last minute, but once you bring my friend here to Manaus, you can consider your debt to me paid in full."
Gustavo broke into an awkward smile. Mia noticed the slow change in Ollie's face. The two men continued shaking while an intense non-verbal conversation passed between them.
"Get in the plane," Ollie hollered, as the sound of vehicles cutting around the distant hangar caught Mia's ear.
She turned to see a convoy of police cars heading toward them.
"You double-crossing son of a bitch, Gustavo," Ollie shouted as he pulled the pistol and aimed it at him. "Don't kill him," Mia pleaded. She'd seen more than enough death in the last 24 hours. "Why would I kill him when he's the only one who can fly us out of here?"
Ollie grabbed Gustavo by the collar and shoved him into the pilot seat.
"That's not to say I won't wound him a little."
Ollie went around to the other side while Mia climbed in the back. The propeller started to spin as Gustavo fiddled nervously with the controls.
"You keep stalling and I'll blow your kneecaps off," Ollie growled. "Now get us in the air."
Mia looked back, butterflies fluttering in her chest. The convoy of cops was getting closer.
"Oh God, hurry up."
Ollie pressed the barrel of the gun to Gustavo's temple and pulled back the hammer.
"Your choice, mate."
Gustavo whimpered and threw the throttle, lurching the plane forward. Behind them, the cops had reached the last hangar.
"Go, go, go!"
Ollie bellowed. Gustavo put on his headset and said a few words in Portuguese. The plane straightened out.
"What are you doing?"
Ollie demanded.
"Waiting for permission from the tower to..."
"Permission granted." Ollie forced the throttle all the way, throwing them back in their seats. Police cars raced out onto the grassy runway and pulled alongside them, their weapons drawn.
"Hold on, everyone,"
Gustavo said, closing his eyes and pulling back on the yoke. Mia felt gravity pushing down on every part of her body as the Cessna climbed into the air.
"Where are we going?"
Gustavo asked, his frantic eyes falling to Ollie's pistol, still trained on him.
"Originally Manaus," Ollie replied, "but thanks to that little stunt you pulled, you're going to have to take us all the way to Buenos Aires."
Gustavo's darkened complexion turned ashen.
"We don't have enough fuel."
Ollie pulled out a map and spread it over his lap.
"One stop in the state of Mato Grosso and another in Paraguay should do just fine."
He turned back to Mia.
"Oh, and you're really going to love the in-flight movie. It's about this guy and girl from opposite sides of the world who get thrown together as they try to stay one step ahead of the authorities."
Chapter 22. Jack pulled his helmet on. As he clicked it in place, a cool rush of air caressed his cheeks. Each of the team members was nestled into a tight-fitting white biosuit made from organic polymers woven into a three-dimensional framework. Far from the unwieldy spacesuit or a bulky hazmat, the biosuit was light, flexible, and filled with an array of biometric and toxicity sensors monitored by Mission Control. In this case, Mission Control was Lieutenant Olson, who in turn would update Admiral Stark on their progress at the top of every hour. Modular sockets on their backs allowed for a hydration bladder and a closed-circuit rebreather, but the pièce de résistance was the fancy-looking glasses they were all given, something Hart referred to as an optical head-mounted display, OHMD. A tiny digital recorder embedded into the right end piece enabled point-of-view video recording. On the left was a holographic display which could project images onto one of the lenses or into the empty space before them. Hand movements could then be used to scroll through maps or to flip through pages of data. Additionally, the glasses were networked, allowing all members to communicate as well as send information to one another. Each suit also had a built-in LED light, 2,000 lumens strong, secured to the top of their helmet. Gabby and Dag headed into the airlock, carrying cases with scientific instruments. Behind them was Anna's upper torso, which had been rigged to a rover platform with variable drive wheels. Jack watched as she navigated the airlock door's lower lip and maneuvered herself inside.